at the center of the 07-08 season, we're continuing a longstanding National Art Center English theater tradition by presenting a play by William Shakespeare. And this year, we're very excited to present his play, Macbeth. And I give it that dramatic pause because some of you may know this, some of you not, that it's in the theater. It's very a bad luck to say this word or to quote any line from the play in a theater on stage. So it's called in the theater the Scottish play. It's called Mackers. It's Mackers. Given. Yep. It's given all these other ways of saying it's to not tempt the ill luck that is said to go with the production. And it's a funny tradition. And what you're supposed to do if you do quote the play or you say the title, you're supposed to leave the room, swear, spit, turn around three times, and ask for permission to come back in. And if you quote a line from the play, you are requested to quote a line from another play of Shakespeare's to erase the curse, quoting the Mackers line you might have quoted. And I think it's Ian McKellen or Simon Cowell, one of the great British Shakespearean actors, who favors quotes from A Midsummer Night's Dream as being the most potent to counter the Scottish curse. So a thing I love is Harold Bloom, who's an American scholar and critic of Shakespeare, and a wonderful read for you guys out there who are interested in reading about him, about Shakespeare and about his plays. And Bloom says, Macbeth is, rumored to be the unluckiest of the plays of Shakespeare, but perhaps it's unluckiest most of all for Macbeth himself. And this is an incredible play. It's one of the four great tragedies of Shakespeare's, with King Lear, Hamlet, and Othello. It's been described as the ruby in the crown of Shakespearean tragedy. And it tells the story of a Scottish thane who, victorious in a battle, kicking the Norwegians out of Scotland, is met by three witches on a heath who deliver a prophecy to him that he will become the thane of Cawdor and of Glamis and eventually king of Scotland. And he returns from this battle to find out that the thane of Cawdor has been executed and he has been given that position. And the first of the witches' prophecy has come true. So he writes his wife with this story of the prophecy, and she is elated and discovers that the king is coming to stay at their castle that very night. And she urges him to take action into their own hands to secure this destiny, and they kill the king of Scotland and get the crown. And from there, the play follows their descent of conscience, of guilt, of horror that follows through from that initial murder. And in order to keep the secret and keep that murder secure, Macbeth kills his best friend, Banquo. He attempts to kill his son. He kills his greatest rival and nemesis, Macduff, his wife, his children. Sorry, he doesn't kill Macduff. He kills his family, but attempts to kill him. And it results in Lady Macbeth taking her own life. And he discovers that he returns to the witches, who tell him that he only has to fear being killed by a man who is of no woman born. So Macbeth feels quite confident and secure that that's an impossibility. He's immortal. He will live forever. But little does he realize that Macduff was from his mother's womb, untimely ripped, born cesarean section. And so is of no woman born. And Macduff ultimately slays him, and King Duncan's sons, Malcolm, is restored to the throne, and things are safe again. It is a very political play. It's a great humanist tragedy, and then it really, through Shakespeare's magnificent use of soliloquy, gets us right up close inside the imagination and thinking of someone who has plotted and has committed a murder. And it's also famous for being one of Shakespeare's most frightening plays, scary plays, mm-hmm. because of the presence of the supernatural is very alive in it. And, you know, we see comic versions of this in Midsummer Night's Dream and romantic elements of this in The Tempest. But here are the real full tragic implications of a demon world full of spirits and familiars and witches abounds in this text. It's very, very exciting to present these plays, and also very challenging, because probably Macbeth is up there with Romeo and Juliet, Hamlet. It's a play that we come to the theater with a lot of preconception about. It's a play that, you know, everyone from The Simpsons to The Flintstones have mm-hmm. make reference to. Mm-hmm. And one of the great challenges that I face, certainly as a director, is how you deal with witches. Mm-hmm. Because Shakespeare's audience would have believed in witches. And to us, they're, you know, characters of fiction, of fantasy. We have these sort of Halloween images of pointy hats, broomsticks, you know, long, crooked nose with wart, with hair on wart.
And broomsticks.
And broomsticks mm-hmm. and cauldrons and all of that. David, this, what is your take on this play, and what's your take on the witchcraft in the play? I think history has a lot to inform us about the original power of this play and what it might hold for us today.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a play that, I'll come back to the witches in a minute, but it's a play that has a lot of political significance for its time. It was probably written around 1606. That's the latest convention anyway, and which means it's at a very crucial time. James the First of England has been on the throne for 3 years. He was actually James the Sixth of Scotland, and had ruled Scotland very effectively for many years. In the late 16th century, his mother, Mary Queen of Scots, had been executed by Elizabeth the First, or on her orders. And James, as the listeners will know, Elizabeth is the Virgin Queen. She doesn't have an heir to the throne, and James the Sixth of Scotland is regarded by most of the political class. He's the inevitable heir, so he's living in Scotland, expecting to become King of England at some point, and his dream is to be the peacemaker of Europe. Very wonderful ideals for the late 16th century, in the middle of these horrible wars of religion that are taking place in many parts of Europe. And he wants to be the peacemaker. He wants to bring the old enemies of Scotland and England together and united in his person in a new country called Britain, Great Britain. And when he does succeed, Elizabeth dies in 1603, and James travels down and comes to the throne. He finds himself in a very peculiar position, because very quickly the English turn on him, and there are performances, public performances in the theaters, which mock his accent and mock his style, and people stand up in Parliament and say that, you know, no Scottish king has ever died in his bed in the last 200 years. They're horribly violent, incomprehensible people. The Eastward Ho, I think there's a reference where, you know, it's better to have 10,000 Scots in Virginia than one in London. You know, well, there is one in London, and he happens to be the king.
Apologies to our Scottish listeners.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, so there's, for James, this is, to have a play that's set in Scottish history is particularly problematic, or is going to be challenging for him. It's enormously challenging for Shakespeare, because a few years earlier, 1600, James had actually been staying with a nobleman called the Earl of Gowrie in a castle, and Gowrie had tried to murder him. And a page runs Gowrie through with a sword, and James makes the page an earl, and all is well. the problem with that is that, first of all, James is the guest of this nobleman who has betrayed James. And the situation you described with yeah. Macbeth actually hosting the king and then killing him must have had very strong... I mean, James,
sure.
We know James reflected on this horrific event, which scared him for the rest of his life and tarred him. So, you know, James knows, Shakespeare knows and James knows that this is a hot button issue for him. Many of the Scots didn't believe that Gowrie had tried to murder James, simply because James owed Gowrie a lot of money and it was enormously convenient to have the Earl killed in that way. So there's some doubt about the whole situation. But James himself then is in a situation where he's trying to control a new country, rule a new country. The opposition of many of the political elite to his presence and to the presence of the Scots, he brings a lot of his favorites, a lot of the lads come down with him. My favorite is Will Hay, who has this wonderful slogan, "Spend and God will send," because James will just give him anything he wants and the expenses get way out of control. But there's also a very hot political issue in terms of the role of the king and the nature of the king. And of course, in the play, there's a direct reference to James in the sense that Banquo is one of James's ancestors.
Yes.
And so when the parade or the imagining, and this must be the challenge for the director, do you show the ghosts or do you not? Is it in his mind or is it actually real? Seeing these ghosts going down to the lane of Banquo,
witches conjure apparitions out of a cauldron, which a line of eight kings comes forward, and
one of them's Banquo,
and one of them's Banquo,
and none James
of them
is
are
his
Macbeth.
Descendant.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
So it's so there's a reference there to the lineage of James, and Shakespeare is quite brilliantly anticipating that in a way, it does take place in a world of magic, and James also was an extraordinary king. He wrote very, very well, wrote a lot of political treatises on the divine right of kings, that kings are appointed by God and therefore deserve to rule, and only gods can judge kings, and something which alienated a lot of people in Parliament, for example. But he also wrote a wonderful tract against tobacco. But an extraordinary tract against, a tract is a small work or treatise, against the inclination of many at the time to deny the existence of witchcraft. The English are very unsure about whether witches exist because of Protestantism. There's the initial impulse when England becomes a Protestant country, as it does once Elizabeth succeeds to the throne in 1558, there's an impulse to deny witchcraft, to see it as part of Catholic superstition, and to dismiss it. That argument loses out, and in the 1580s and 1590s, witchcraft is taken very seriously in England, but even more seriously in Scotland. And one of the reasons for that is James himself. He writes a book on demonology, which impresses on the reader the real existence of witches, that witches are real, they do horrific things, they try to cause Sirek, when he's visiting Denmark, and one of the witches examined can remember what he said in bed to Anne of Denmark, and they were in Denmark, so the witch was in Berwick in Scotland. So how does she know this? It's obviously demonic influence. And there's a witch craze that's launched by James. James is one of the great, not actually, but he launches this witch hunt. So he's very fearful of witches. So you're touching on several hot button issues there. One, the Scottishness of the play itself is a problematic for politics at the time. Secondly, you're staging one of the key scenes where the king is being murdered by his guest, which is something that almost happened to James himself. And then you're wrapping the whole thing up in the world of demonology and witchcraft, which is something that James takes so seriously. He writes a treatise to make sure that everyone is on board wanting to combat this world. So it's this underworld, this other world. So it's an extraordinary risky play in many ways. A play on the Earl of Gowrie had just been suppressed by the government. So, Shakespeare's treading risky waters.
So I think I love in Shakespeare, there's a wonderful doubleness of meaning all the time. You know, a fact that always surprises me is that there is only one scene in all of Shakespeare that actually takes place in England in the time he lived. And that's the opening induction to Taming of the Shrew. One scene, and then it launches to Padua or someplace. All of his plays are set in a historical time or in a foreign location. And it's often said he did this to, deal with critics and censorship of the time. He could speak very pertinently to his time and place, but go, but I'm really setting it in Vienna, or it's really set in Verona or someplace else. And that is certainly true of Macbeth. Also, in regard to the gunpowder plot. So here, you know, here we have a Scottish king on the throne, and this is a play about a violent murder and a falsely supplanted Scottish king. But it's also about people trying to attack the reinstatement of the true Scottish king, with Malcolm being crowned at the end. Could you just tell us a little bit about the gunpowder plot and its influences on the play?
Yeah, one of the exciting things about James coming to the throne, as far as many of many English people are concerned, as well as many Scots, is that the world will change for the better. Courtiers believe there'll be more money available for them. Catholics believe that the anti-Catholic legislation that Elizabeth had passed in the last two decades of her reign will be reversed, and the Catholics will be reinstated as part of the political community. Radical Protestants who are upset at the Church of England, the Anglican Church that has been established, which still has some elements of Catholicism in it, like bishops, the existence of bishops, that bishops will be swept away and will have a more reformed, a more radically Protestant church. So everyone's hoping that James will do all of these things, and of course he can't do all of them. The group that is most disappointed initially are the Catholics, where James makes it very clear that he's not going to reinstate toleration or bring in toleration for Catholics. And a very small group of radical, fanatical Catholics decide to blow up Parliament at the opening of Parliament. And that's bad enough, but perhaps what listeners don't know entirely is that at the opening of Parliament, the entire political community is there. Not only the lords of the realm, the earls and the dukes and the barons and so on, but all the judges are there at the opening of Parliament. The judges actually sit in the House of Lords. The members of the House of Commons stand at the bottom of the House of Lords, and that would mean all the justices of the peace and the sheriffs and all the government of the county communities, all the leading citizens of the key towns, York, Norwich, London, are there. So some foreign ambassadors would be there, and it's very likely that most of James's family, including his sons, his children, will be there. So you really would have destroyed the entire political community. It's a horrific proposal, and whether you go for the conspiracy theory that in fact the government was well aware of it and let it run its course until the last minute, and then you know, captured everybody. I don't think there's a lot of validity to that myself. This is a genuine plot, and it comes close to succeeding. And so, yeah, Macbeth is responding to that. I think that situation, and there's some wonderful language in Macbeth. There's a lot of play on words, as you know, and although you're not obviously allowed to use these words in the theater, but before a performance. But if you say something like equivocate, which is a word that's used a lot significantly in Macbeth. The groundlings again, or perhaps the wealthier sort that are watching the play, would have known what that referred to, because equivocation is a hot topic at the time, because one of the Catholics arrested and is interrogated equivocates. He lies when he's being tortured, and he's guaranteed his place in heaven by the Pope, because you're allowed to lie under torture to preserve and protect fellow Catholics. So although you're not supposed to lie, in certain cases you have to equivocate and you have to lie in order to preserve the greater good of the cause of Catholicism. And there's a lot of play about the deceit and the equivocation and the doubling of words and the double meaning of words. And from the witches through to many of the characters in Macbeth, the double meaning of things is crucial. So we have some contemporary phrases and language, and as well as episodes that are used or events that are used in the play that would have jolted the memory of people. These are issues. Father Garnet's equivocation is being talked about on the streets of London at the very time. Yeah. So when you talk about equivocation in Macbeth, it's when one of the characters talks about that. It means something very large to those people that are watching in a way that perhaps we've lost. We wouldn't quite understand that.
Well, that's always the challenge with the play is on one hand, it's a very philosophical play. It has some of the most beautiful verse in Shakespeare, but it's also a very action-centered play.
Right.
It's the shortest of the tragedies. It comes in at like 2 hours and 25 minutes. So it's rip-roaring plot and action. And it makes it, you know, very satisfying as a director because it's not just a thought happening in a sort of languid vacuum. It's you must understand the consequence of what you've done in order to continue. And I read recently a very interesting comparison of the play to Hamlet, which Marty Meriden directed here a few seasons back with Tom Rooney as Hamlet. That Hamlet, Macbeth is the inversion of the play Hamlet. Macbeth is all Hamlet's all about, should I do it? What should I do? What's the right action to take? And he finally takes action late in the play. As where Macbeth, he takes action right away and then goes, was that the right thing to do? Should I have done that? What will happen now?
Yeah.
And so it contains, again, tremendous action and plot and excitement and very serious philosophy and contemplation of very serious themes.
And it's, you know, that issue of choice and consequence is also another major philosophical discussion at the time over issues of, you know, the stronger sorts of Protestants who opposed the existence of bishops, for example, believed in predestination, that God had ordained the fate of humanity.
Yeah.
And that means there's a question of free will and choice. So, you know, for the audience, does Macbeth have free will? Does he make a free choice to kill? Or does he, in fact, not have any choice at all because that's his destiny, that's his providence? And so it opens up that for debate. And, of course, Lady Macbeth herself, as a director, I suspect you're trying to decide, you know, do you play her like a virago who eggs her husband on and basically he's doing what she wants him to do?
Yeah.
Or is she someone who's a compassionate wife, a loyal wife who has uncovered what the husband really wants and knows what he really wants and therefore is encouraging him to get to where he really wants to be? And so what's her role in this? And I love that scene where we talked earlier about medicine and Molière, and partly is all about bleeding and blood. And, you know, there are four humors and blood of which is one. And that's the one that you can deal with because phlegm and cholera and bile are things that are very difficult to drain.
Yeah, the humors were kind of like Elizabethan psychology, if you will. Based on your nature or character was distinguished by what kind of liquids you had in your body.
In your body. And an imbalance was what the doctors were trying to deal with. So, you know, they'd pull your blood out to try and create
calm
a better balance and calm you down.
Yes.
But blood's associated especially with men because men contain their blood in their bodies. Women, of course, menstruate and they lose their blood.
Right.
So women are cold, men are hot. And the wonderful thing about Lady Macbeth, well, there are many wonderful things about the character, but one of the intriguing things, I think, is her relationship to blood and the famous scene where she's trying to get the blood to come out and it won't come out.
Yes.
She's almost become anti-woman. She's become a man. She's hot like a man. And so she's not wet and has...
And she's always referring to the liquids in her, to take her milk for gall.
So there's that whole, you know, what Macbeth and... Macbeth's important enough, but Lady Macbeth, in fact, for me, is somewhat more, even more fascinating as a character.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, a great play.
It is a fantastic play. And I think that, you know, the witchcraft is an interesting way in because, you know, I've met hardly anybody who has no interest in that subject, whether it's a period kind of, whoa, what were the demon books like to.
Yeah.
Just our fascination with you know, what some critics call the Holocaust of women. That was, you know, thousands and thousands of women were accused of this. And one of the things it reveals is one of the tests for witchcraft was dunking, where a witch was put into a bag with a rooster, a dog, and a cat. You can imagine. And then dunked into the river for 5 minutes. And the theory went that if she survived this, she was obviously a witch and was burned at the stake and hung. If she didn't survive it, she was innocent. And rest assured, she would go to heaven. And that, you know, in contrast to equivocation, that kind of inquisition that took place and that kind of intolerance is also really apt to the play. And we're going to see in a later play, too, this takes on a kind of allegorical level to the persecution of the Catholics. But
Well, I'm going to just interrupt you for a second because there's a woodcut. And when I talk about woodcuts, I'm literally, it's a piece of wood which is cut into and then inked. And then the paper is rolled on top. So you end up, and you often end up with these woodcuts. But there's, and we also know from some of the witchcraft trials and account books, because this is something that is done legally. It's not done by a mob. It's done by authority, and they pay people to do this. So we have accounts where they say, so 2 pence to so-and-so to take the ducking stool to the river and so on. But they did actually tie the witch with a rope. So most of them didn't drown after proving their innocence. They were yanked out at the last minute, so they didn't all drown, the innocent ones. And that was the theory anyway. But we don't know how many of them actually did drown, proving their innocence. But some of them hopefully did get pulled out and were alive and were found to be innocent. But it's an extraordinary, you know, very iconic experience of this term. I mean, I think Holocaust is too strong, but certainly some scholars use that word. If you took some of the statistics literally, there would have been very few children born with the number of women that some scholars claim were killed as witches. But, you know, witches were, you know, there is certainly in parts of Europe, there's thousands of women killed. And in particular pockets, in particular towns, in particular places, there you have men in charge of witchcraft hunts and they kill hundreds. And then literally 20 miles away, people will be arrested for witchcraft and be let free. So it's very hard for us as historians to work out what the whole phenomena is about. And is it a hatred of women? Is it a fear of women? Is it part of this medical? One of the theories we talked about with Molière is that it's the medical profession trying to push women out of midwifery or out of herbal medicine, and witches, of course, are known to practice those sorts of medicines. The interesting thing for this play, I think, is that contemporaries were well aware of the demonology aspect of witchcraft, but that was unique to Scotland. In England, most witches weren't accused of fornicating with the devil in the woods or flying around with backwards or anything like that. Most witches in England were accused of curdling the milk or attacking protein, sometimes maiming or killing children or people, but usually cattle or milk or so on. It was all about bad neighbors, basically. And elderly women in the community were often marginalized in terms of income. They're often begging people, begging for alms and so on. And they were often accused when things went wrong. They were the marginal group that it was easy to scapegoat when the milk turned sour or a cattle died. You know, there's whole many layers of witchcraft that I think are quite fascinating. But he has the demonology in this play.
And then the challenge comes for us is how do we translate those ideas of witchcraft to our own society today that reveal our own intolerance, our own fear, our own social regulation and control, and that's the great excitement of
interpreting Shakespeare. Yeah, because we look for scapegoats all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.